Hi, John.
So, hi, Dio. Nice to talk to you.
Great to speak with you as well.
So, how are you doing? Yeah.
Good. It's been a kind of a crazy week here in D.C.
I can imagine.
We'll get to all of that stuff. But starting with the Sotomayor hearings and then the president's being abroad, coming back, and then giving this speech in New York and a return to the campaign trail in some ways.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to keep on top of it.
I'm very happy about that speech. I really think that that is one for the books. And the reason that I think that is because I like the way he makes full acknowledgement of the fact that there are obstacles that black people face that mm-hmm. most white people don't. And he really does acknowledge it. He doesn't just give it one sentence, you know, like somebody like me often does. He actually dwells on it, plus with the cadence and everything. And then he specifies, though, that there are no excuses. And I think that those two things together are exactly what everybody needs to hear. And nobody could say it better than he did. Although, in a way, I'm not sure whether the audience necessarily knew what they were clapping for. I mean, it's one thing to clap when somebody says no excuses. It's another thing to really start going on the basis of that. But I thought he really, really hit the bullseye there.
What's your take on the sort of the media response to the speech? I know that a lot of the headlines did focus on that sort of no excuses thing. And this has been something that we've seen throughout the president's period of public life mm-hmm. where he talks to black people about fatherhood, mm-hmm. where he talks to people in Ghana about, you know,
do it yourself,
good governance, etc. Mm-hmm. And the reaction from the sort of majority culture and the mainstream media is to say, well, you know, we're so relieved that Obama could say that because we couldn't, but we totally think that.
Mm-hmm.
And then that sort of puts these sort of camps at odds with one another mm-hmm. in a strange way, where there's a resentment that, you know, as Jesse Jackson put it very crudely, that he's talking down to black people.
Sure.
Or on the other hand, that, you know, people in the black community are like, we've been saying this for years.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this so surprising
mm-hmm.
to all of these white folks? Like, you don't think we beat our kids? You don't think we give people a whooping every once in a while when they cut class?
Yeah.
So there's this weird audience question. So I'm just curious what you think of the media treatment of this and which audience Obama was addressing in New York.
Yeah, I think that Obama was addressing the black audience. And
mm-hmm.
I think that certainly the media enjoy it when a black figure gives that kind of message. And I think it's always going to be that way, partly because it makes for good TV, and partly, let's be honest, because I think that majority white opinion, including in blue America, is that there's something missing in the black community in terms of the fact that whatever the government can do, that ultimately the main impetus has to come from within. And, you know, to tell you the truth, Dio, if that were the media in 1973, I would have a little bit more of a problem with it. But it's gotten to the point, and opinions will differ, but I really think that the main issues now are ones where the main impetus has to come from us, although we have to have the conditions in which we can do it. And if the black community knows this, and the black community certainly knows this, that's definitely the case, then I think that that's
right.
the most important thing. It seems, for me, the issue here is, what would the alternative be? You know, do the people who get itchy, and people are already itchy this morning about Obama saying that in front of white America, the media going
mm-hmm.
crazy, do they want him to get up and say, the government has to take care of us, America is on the hook, and the NAACP starts cheering?
Oh, okay, right.
I don't
right.
know, how do you feel
about
that?
I think that you're missing the distinction between the types of speeches that Obama can give. Like, yes, there's people who are going to be upset because he's, whatever, talking down to black people,
mm.
but that's not really the divide. I think Obama, if you listen to his rhetoric, he gives two different kinds of speeches when he talks about blackness. There's obviously the very famous A More Perfect Union speech that he gave in Philadelphia in 08. But then there's the speech he gave in Selma, Alabama in 2007,
mm-hmm.
maybe 2006, which is this famous Joshua Generation speech, where he very much is a supplicant to the African-American tradition and the giants of the Civil Rights era.
Yeah.
Where he says, I stand on the shoulder of giants. We are the Joshua Generation. Moses took people to the Promised Land. Joshua led them across the river. And I am the Joshua Generation that will take this legacy further.
Mm-hmm.
And that is sort of a very much of a sop to the sort of older generations of black Americans who are a lot of the folks who are in that room. I mean, the average age of the NAACP's membership is 55.
Right.
And then there's a sort of tough love speech, which now that he is president,
mm-hmm.
because before he was president, it was sort of about winning the approval of this older generation.
Mm-hmm.
Now that he is president, he's making more of a focus on setting his own agenda, on talking about this sort of this tough love, this sort of, you know, get your house in order thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it's a public airing of dirty laundry,
mm-hmm.
but I think that it's very necessary. I agree with you that the speech was good and was really well received. But I do think that, you know, Obama is now stepping into his role as the head Negro in chief in a way that he wasn't always doing before. And I think people give him credit for that and
like,
feel like he has earned that title and that platform.
I hope so. And I think that he is doing that partly just by being himself, but the fact that he can put some voice to it and that he can do it with a kind of love coming through no matter what he says. I must admit that the Joshua Generation speech, I worried about that one because the truth is, especially when you make a speech, when you're using language orally instead of having something written down that people are going to study, there are general impressions that are left. And when you talk about being the Joshua Generation, you're right, and I wouldn't say it's a sop to the older generation, but the general construction of that speech was, I know what people did in the past to make someone like me possible. And in a sense, that's what impression was left of that one. What was left of that one, especially where it was given, was we can't forget the past and just leaving it there. And I think we both know what that message about we can't forget the past means. Often it means the present is still the past. So I like these more forward-looking speeches. I don't think anybody could do it like him. And that's not to say that there aren't problems. And it was so wonderful the way he spelled them out. It was interesting.
Do you agree with that point about he said at some point, I believe that there has never been less discrimination ever than today. I mean, I've been down to the Hill. I've seen these confirmation hearings, the optics of, you know, 19 white men questioning a Latina woman.
Optics.
We can talk much more about Sotomayor, but do you agree with his statement that there has never been less discrimination in America than there is today?
Well, of course I do. Dio, I hope that you do too. I mean, the way I see it is that, yes, discrimination happens. And so, for example, we just saw some rather obvious discrimination with the Philadelphia swimming pool incident where whatever was going on with the administration of the pool, and I think that was kind of complicated, there were people sitting there saying, what are these black kids doing in the pool? There are no two ways to read that. That's just the old-fashioned stuff. But the issue is degree. And I don't know how you feel about this, but I really feel in my gut, and this is not just a line I've made up to score, this is what I feel. When I was 12, I started thinking about this. Someone discriminates against me, someone calls me something, and that sort of thing happened a lot more when I was 12 in 1977 than it happens now, 30-plus years later. I would always think, for me to really walk around and adopt this as a burden would be to insult my own parents and grandparents, given the sorts of things that they went through. And so, yeah, there's less. And I think that the conditioned response is to say, but there's not none. Okay, there isn't, but I think that it's a completely new day. The lives that you and I can lead. Yeah, Obama was right. Did that rankle you to hear him say that?
No, it didn't. I mean, I think just to recap for those people who maybe don't understand, that the Valley Swim Club in Philadelphia kicked out a group of young black students because they were black. There had been a transaction where some camp counselor had paid for these kids to get into the camp, and then when the director of the club saw all these black kids running around, it was like, whoa, stop. And then kicked it out. People sort of kicked up a stink about this. There have been online petitions. There's been calls left at the swim club number. And a lot of people are really angry about this.
Mm-hmm.
And this ties into sort of the greater question of political organizing in the 21st century and in the age of Obama. I've written a piece recently with regards to the NAACP centennial, which talks about like how you really deal with these questions.
Mm-hmm.
When something happens, discrimination of this nature,
mm-hmm.
Do you start a march, you know, which is maybe what would have happened 50, 60 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
Do you start a protest or a sit-in? Do you write letters to your senator? Do you sit, you know, there are all these different sort of methodologies,
mm-hmm.
and increasingly you see the NAACP sort of reacting, and groups and men like Al Sharpton sort of, something happened, we're going to go to the place where it happened and we're going to say that it happened,
mm-hmm.
but there's no preventative aspect, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's prevention. Medicine is worth a pound of cure, and that's a prevention. And I just feel like black organizing now doesn't really have a preventative capacity. And I think that's where Obama is making a difference, in that he has policy prescriptions that sort of have a broader, cast a broader net, you know, where they're
mm-hmm.
catching kids who are a lot of kids who have, you know, risk of not having health care, or a lot of kids who are at risk of dropping out of school. And so these are not race-targeted practices or discrimination-targeted practices, but they're sort of general policy initiatives that catch the problem of discrimination where it lies in a way that just having a protest or just writing letters to a swim club doesn't do. So it's really about tactics more than it is about the question of whether people are discriminated against more or less today.
You know, now we're going to have, like, postmodern blogging heads, because I want to go back to the beginning of what you said, and that it's not going to relate seamlessly to going to the end of what you said. But, so, everybody remembers what you just said about the Valley Swimming Club, and I want to just add to that that I dug around in that a bit. I'm from Philadelphia, and I happened to be there last weekend, happened to meet some people who knew some local things. And what's interesting about that case, it was really a very 2009 kind of racism case, is that it has a bearing on the question that the same club had also asked two other day school, daycare, day camp groups not to come, who were basically all white groups, you know, maybe a few of some other things, but these were white groups, asked them not to come because they were overwhelmed by the numbers. And so that had happened before. But then when the head of the club defended what happened with the black group, he used the word complexion, which was really, really not the right word to use. But this is the same man who had also not allowed, after having allowed, two white groups of similar composition to come. And so it ends up being a less cut and dried case than it might seem. And so, you know, the jury's still out. And like I said, there were people sitting there saying, who are these black kids? They might steal something. That's just right there. What the Deuslers, the couple who own the club, what was really going through their mind, I think time will tell. I don't know if it's as easy as it seemed when the headlines first hit. But, go ahead.
I think your opinion on the Philly case is a little bit out of the mainstream, just because, you know, it's so devastating to be a young child and to feel like you're being discriminated against for reasons you can't understand. And so there's a real, like, sympathy thing that really has rallied people. And it is shocking when you just hear the basic facts of it. And it's good of you to go and sort of probe a little deeper into the specifics of the case. But I guess, again, this seems a little like small ball. I mean, the real question maybe is how many public pools are available for young children, et cetera, et cetera. And then again, the same way that you have people protesting the New York Post cartoons or, and again, the NAACP and new groups like The Color of Change, which I've written about as well, get people emailing about, you know, the Oscar Grant shooting in Oakland
That's January a good example, this year,
or Sean Bell or what have you.
Right.
And I guess I just don't see the direct connection between agitating against specific instances of racism and fighting racism in general. I just don't actually see them correlating.
That's interesting.
I don't see how sending an email to several dozen friends about the Gina 6 fights racism.
Right.
And I don't know that there is a policy prescription for that. Like, increasingly, I've sort of come around to the idea that it is, and this sounds really sort of DC and terrible, but it is sort of, you know, national policies that can actually, and I guess I would say state and local policies as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe if everybody went to their city council meeting or what have you and agitated for, you know, better representation, you know, on that council for different people of color.
Oh, sure.
Like interests with those economically aligned interests or what have you. That might be a more effective prescription. I just am not sure people are examining their methodology, and the NAACP is particularly guilty of not examining its methodology in terms of fighting the fight of colored people in America, which itself sounds anachronistic.
And I agree with that, and I'm going to get to that in just a second. We're closer on the pool case than it seems, because actually I feel that one of the upshots of it that can't be ignored is that whatever the technicalities, imagine being one of those kids. And we can't put on the kids to, you know, understand all these ins and outs and subtleties. I don't like doing this on Blogging Heads because I find it a little tacky. But I did do a piece in my New Republic page on this. And so for anybody who wants to know how I feel about this and what I found out, that's where it is. But in terms of the NAACP, it's interesting. I think that we need innovative thinking, and you're right, preventative is important. Like, for example, Oscar Grant is a young black man who it looks like was basically killed in cold blood by policemen on the BART train system out in Oakland. And again, this is one of those cases where we don't know all the facts yet, but still, it's very difficult to see that whether it's difficult to see that it could possibly be the case that something didn't go horribly wrong.
Right.
And the preventative issue, I think, is making sure that fewer young black men are in situations where anything like that would be likely to occur. For example, whatever happened to Oscar Grant specifically, it doesn't seem to be that he was just sitting in his seat on the train and somebody came up and shot a gun at him. There are these things right. that escalate. And I think that jobs is very important. And already people are talking about a particular black unemployment crisis. And then,
it's
say,
terrible.
Take the headlines today where Obama is talking about the funding that's being given to community colleges. And
right.
that's crucial in terms of what you might even call race-targeted legislation, because those community colleges are not for Justin and Caitlin from Scarsdale. And I think we need to get the word out in communities what sorts of non-four-year college jobs there are, what sort of certificate, what sort of AA you need to get. And it seems to me that the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, if they're really interested in the advancement of said people, would be better put in devoting a whole lot of resources to being behind that effort and getting more black people into these community colleges based on these new funds than
right.
on, you know, the ambulance chasing, so to speak, which makes for good drama and is often necessary in itself. But I would hope that it wouldn't be the main meal. What worries me is that it's the drama that the NAACP chases rather than what actually helps the black poor.
Yeah.
So I'm with you,
no,
I'm with you on
with
that.
You. Have you heard about this new initiative of theirs surrounding the centennial? And the piece I wrote for The Root focused on technology, basically.
Yeah.
But they've rolled out this new program where you can text message or, like, take a short video on your cell phone of police brutality when it happens
mm-hmm.
and send it into the NAACP, and then they'll send you back a police report form.
Mm-hmm.
That's, like, literally their, like, Web 2.0 platform.
Nice idea.
And I hate to sort of pound them so and be so critical about that, but not only is it provincial, it deals only with police brutality, which is reductive and doesn't take advantage of the mandate they have to sort of enforce protections and rights and liberties for a whole host of people. And just parenthetically, Obama expanded that mandate when he spoke to them on Thursday, talking about Muslim Americans, talking about gay Americans,
mm-hmm.
talking about Latinos. And Ben Jealous has mentioned to me in an interview wanting to expand the NAACP's purview to Latinos, to Asian Americans, particularly in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
So they have a bigger tent than they're allowing.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have their whole new media strategy and communication strategy, which is so important these days,
mm-hmm.
you and I both know, focus around, like, the text messaging to the website. Like, it just, it's the worst idea I've ever heard, I guess is what I'm saying. And it just is remarkable to me that would be, you know, this is the organization that is 100 years old, that has the best brand, that, you know, fought Plessy versus mm-hmm. Ferguson, that did all of this, and is, like, talking about text messaging, pictures of Oscar Grant to you know, like,
you know what?
I just don't. It's small ball. It's terrible.
You know what? I have to disagree on this, fully understanding where you're coming from, and I'm sitting here wanting to nod my head. I started commenting on race. It's getting to be 10 years ago now, and you learn a lot of things when you come out of nowhere. You weren't a race person, and you're just kind of learning the ropes. And I found that I came out with this message that it's not like it used to be. And the main obstacle, the main thing that was on people's minds was not issues of health insurance. It wasn't that black people don't always get car loans that are as good as white people. It was the police. That was the main thing standing between mm-hmm. the sort of thing I was saying, or other people who are genuine black conservatives were saying, and the mainstream. It was two things. One, police brutality, and at that time, Amadou Diallo was more resonant in people's minds.
Mm-hmm.
And two, the proportion of black men in jail. And I've
right.
since realized that, and now I didn't know Obama was coming, but I would have said, say, 3 years ago, we will never truly get past the idea that the main obstacle is racism until we iron out this relationship between young black men and police forces. And I think that that's still there to an extent. I think that if there were no reason to think that black men labored under a particular danger of being killed or hurt or persecuted by mostly white police forces, then there'd be a whole generation that would have a whole different and more constructive view about race. And so for me, I must admit that this initiative with the cell phones and the pictures and avoiding more Oscar Grants or making those cases easier to prosecute, I kind of like that because there is a valve of steam that a lot of people need to blow off about the police and black men. I'm sure you've noticed that.
Right.
I
just don't think it's a deterrent to police officers that someone might be
no?
sending something to the NAACP.
Hmm.
No.
Interesting.
Actually, okay, wait. I feel bad ragging on the NAACP, because we did a podcast yesterday at The Root, and Sherilyn Eiffel, who does legal affairs, just made this point, which is that, you know, the NAACP, the things they were saying to Sonia Sotomayor about La Raza, they would never have dared to say that about the NAACP. So it does have a certain clout. It does have a certain gravitas.
Yeah.
Right? You can't really denigrate it as being, like, you know,
No.
Militant.
They'd say that about black Muslims or something, but not the NAACP.
Right,
yeah.
Right, exactly. So I will give it its due there. But I just feel like the cultural impact that it could have and the sort of weight that it could throw around, it's not doing. I mean, it's not, it could shift to a more sophisticated type of engagement with politics where it's making, where it could be a policy shop. It could be a black Center for American Progress, easily.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not.
Mm-mm.
And I just don't know what direction they're going and how they're going to compete with groups like the Color of Change and have 50% more members and are doing all the mobilizing, you know, on you know, through methods that MoveOn perfected.
Yeah.
So I just don't really see where it's going with that. And, you know, it's sort of tough.
You know what they need, actually? And now I'm going to go with you on this because, you know, I've had my criticisms of the NAACP. This is the main thing with them, and I think people lose this because especially we Americans are very short-sighted people. There are always these things that they say that they're going to do. But really, if you let some time go by, and I don't mean 25 years, but like 2 years, then you find that there is a distinct disjunction between what goes on and what they say they're going to do. And I hate to say that, but it's important because often when someone like you or someone like me come along and start criticizing them, they say, well, look at these initiatives we've got. Generally, each year, around now, when they have their convention, they're five. I don't know why that's the magic number. But if you go back and look at, for example, an address that Mfume gave in August 2001 about the sorts of things they were going to do, it sounds like something that would have W.E.B. Du Bois, tears rolling down his cheek. It's something Obama would love. It's something you would love, something I would love. That's the organization. They didn't do any of those things. What they were mostly concerned with at the time was counting the number of black faces on network television when network television is like 0.2% of what's on TV. And that's the problem. It's that not what they say they're going to do. Another thing that representatives will often say is, well, we've been talking to such and such. Well, okay, talking, but what did it lead to? It's that. If you go back into each address, and so right now, anything that they're talking about they're going to do, we don't expect that in 700 days they're going to have done 100% or even 90%. But to be honest, if the past 15 years are any indication, what they're talking about right now, maybe about 15% of it will happen and sort of. And yes, that means that they end up becoming an obsolete organization, and it worries me because they have such power, they have such cachet, they have all these people, they have all these resources, they should not be extinct, but they have to matter in the ways that matter in 2009.
Well, the ways that matter in 2009, just to segue a little bit, seem to be completely fixated around race. I mean, if you had watched, you know, even half of the confirmation hearings for Judge Sotomayor this week, you would have been convinced that, you know, the biggest threat facing America is the sort of the plight of the white male, you know, that they're at the greatest risk of. I mean, you would have never realized that we went through 400 years of state-sanctioned prejudice.
I would never have thought of it that
way. Against people of color.
Yeah.
Had you just landed from Mars and watched Sonia Sotomayor go through what she went through this week. So it seemed odd to me just in that case that it was the senators who were race-obsessed. It was the senators who could not let go. And who kept bringing again the conversation back to the question of whether or not a wise Latina would make a better decision than a white man, or whether or not poor Frank Ritchie had had his life destroyed by the affirmative action policies of New Haven, and whether or not, you know, just the sort of optics, as I mentioned before, of seeing a Latino supplicate a body of white men for the most part, said anything about the Republican Party or American politics in general. It was just almost like a sideshow. I couldn't believe it.
All right. Thought experiment, though. I mean, our job is always to try to put ourselves into other people's heads, I think. And so imagine, you know, we're so used to Sonia Sotomayor's wise Latina comment. It doesn't resonate in our minds anymore, and certainly not the way it does to a conservative, white, often male person. Imagine if that was a black woman who said it. Let's get that fresh in our minds, how that would sound if we were hearing it new. I'm going to create a black woman. I'm going to make a black name. Her name is Brenda Peyton Presley. just making that up. Brenda Payton Pressley is a woman who's come through the ranks. She's got the same qualifications. And she says, well, I would think that a wise black woman would be in a position to make a better, and remember, she did say better.
She said better
judgment than a white man who hadn't had my experiences. Now, that is fighting words. And I think I know why Ms. Pressley would say that. I think I know where she's coming from. I also think that Ms. Pressley wouldn't genuinely think that she was morally superior to a white person, but I can see her saying that to a Black Law Association out of a sense of cultural fellowship in order to lend people a sense of potential. I think that that operates on a kind of a right brain level as opposed to Judge Pressley's left brain ability to be a judge. And I think that's what happened with Sonia Sotomayor. But do you really expect whites who are not Latino, who are not black, and who have not had certain experiences to spontaneously understand that and not bristle a bit to hear someone say, because I am of color, I am a better judge than someone who's white? I would cut them a little slack on that, especially since they're kicking hard enough to derail her. Go ahead.
Right. I think it's firstly a political question. It's like, if there's, I mean, that was the only chink in the armor. I mean, this woman spent 17 years on the federal bench. She's extremely smart. She's very bright. She's dealt with the law from a million different perspectives
right.
as a litigator, as a prosecutor, et cetera, et cetera. So that was sort of the only thing that they could really attack politically. Mm-hmm. However, culturally, the point that you're making is it sounds like apologia for sort of white ignorance of white privilege. Right, the fact that white people are very rarely aware of being white, and therefore being unaware of being of what experiences might accrue to a person of color.
I don't
color.
Think that can change, yeah.
Right, I mean, what she was trying to say, and she said it poorly, and she apologized, didn't really apologize, but sort of walked it back, is that the spectrum of experiences that she's had in white people land and outside of white people land comprise a body of knowledge that is bigger than the experience of white people. And
right.
So in fact, from a strictly empirical, if we could quantify these experiences as being roughly equal to one another, she has twice the experience.
That's what you're
spent all this time.
You're saying
man.
That.
You know,
she didn't
that's the defense of that commentary. You know, she didn't say that, but
yeah, but
I think that that's sort of the point she's making, that like, look, like I know what it's like to be a woman, and we famously, you know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg in the, forgetting the name of the case, this case where a child was strip searched for Advil. And
yeah,
a woman.
Yeah.
Being a woman was important there because these guys were like, isn't it like the locker room? And of course it was not.
Right.
So having just a little bit more experience, not better, which was the wrong word to have used, but more literally experience because
I don't understand the difference. What you're saying sounds better to me.
She experiences the world of the Bronx where she grew up, the, you know, very colorful descriptions of Puerto Rican cuisine that she's given. And she also experiences what it's like to be in the Yale Law Review and to be in, you know, in Robert Morgenthau's
right.
wood-paneled office in New York City.
Right.
And so that, for the people who've only been in the wood-paneled office in New York, they do not understand everything else, right? And so
Dahlia, you think it is better. Because Ruth Gator
Ruth
Bader Ginsburg's judgment,
maybe better.
That was better, wasn't it? I mean, if she was in a position to understand how that invasiveness would have felt, which, you know, I as a man definitely cannot as much, then it seems to me like that was probably better. And so you would give Sonia...
No, I would just say it's more experience. She has more, just like she has 15 years more on the bench than John Roberts, she has 40, however old she is, years more of being Latina experience, you know, and I'm experiencing what it's like to live in poverty and travel through, you know, the world of being a minority. I think that's more experience. It's not better. I think that's, I still maintain that that was the wrong word to use, but it's more. She knows more about America, I would say, than John Roberts.
Wow, that's subtle.
Sorry, it's true.
I genuinely feel that you're saying that there is an advantage that she brings. And you know, I don't think that's a ridiculous statement. Is that what you're saying, that she brings an advantage?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. I mean, I guess, you know, the people, and I've said this before, I think on Talking Heads, people who are of color have, you know, encounter people who are different more often than people who are not encounter people who are different, right? So that's just the case. And, you know, I guess from her perspective, what I sort of disliked about the way just to move back to the actual shenanigans of the confirmation mm-hmm. hearing, that what I disliked about the way it went is that it wasn't an opportunity to educate. It wasn't seen as an opportunity to talk about what it's like to be a Latina or to talk about how the law might be applied differently. Mm-hmm. It was an opportunity to talk about what a judge does or how a judge does it. It became a conversation fixated upon race, upon white grievance, mm-hmm. upon, and I don't know who these senators thought they were scoring points with, but they really did think that they were scoring points with some plurality of Americans who feel aggrieved by affirmative action. They weren't talking about the law. They weren't engaging her the way they engaged Alito and they engaged Roberts, even though she's just as smart as they were. Mm-hmm. They were talking about race when she could have gone in and out on constitutional theory just like they did with the other confirmation hearing.
Sure they did.
So that was what was most disappointing to me.
It's certainly an obsession, and it's certainly a sign of a party adrift in many ways. It's interesting. I just keep thinking about the idea of the more that somebody brings. Because mm-hmm. I think intuitively I sense that I might think that Ruth Bader Ginsburg would have Sonia Sotomayor's contribution pretty much covered herself. Not only because she's a woman, but because she's a woman of liberal politics who's generally been very sensitive to the experience of people of other mm-hmm. races, partly because, I suppose, of her Jewish heritage.
They're New Yorkers.
Right, and so she'd be okay. Now let's take somebody, make it Robert Bader Ginsburg. Let's say it's a guy, and you can kind of make up a certain person who does not happen to be on the court right now. But imagine if Jerry Nadler or somebody were on the court. You'd figure, well, he kind of gets it. So there's a kind of white person who would get it, but you're saying that somebody who is a woman and of color, that person is going to get it more than, you know, a white guy
right.
would. And then
well,
there are white
wanna,
guys who don't
yeah.
get it at all. So like,
I don't want to engage in sort of an ethnic determinism because,
okay.
you know, as we know, there are black people, Barack Obama is a good example, who don't really understand the black experience and had to sort of go and find the black experience.
Right.
So it's not something that sort of is genetic, that accrues to you just by virtue of having a certain skin color.
No.
Certainly, you know, I'm a Nigerian American. My experience of being black in America is different from most other people.
Uh-huh.
Just because my cultural background is not black American.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I walk around with black skin. So I don't think that, you know, it's deterministic of the experience you will have. And certainly, you know, there are plenty of folks like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. It's actually a very good example. Who are sympathetic, who understand sort of what it's like to be in a minority without necessarily being of that ethnic group
mm-hmm.
themselves. You know, more broadly, Sotomayor has been very sort of, she's played by the rules, you know, the entire way. Like, she's been very establishmentarian
mm-hmm.
In a way that's very different from someone else, you know, that came from the Bronx when it's Puerto Rican, you know, her peers.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama said this in his speech. This was ad-libbed to the NAACP. He drives through D.C. and he drives through Chicago and he sees kids on the street corners, and he says, "There but for the grace of God go I."
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very, you know, relevant here. Not as though it's some terrible thing to be someone who's disadvantaged and is born into poverty, but that there was a fork in the road for Sonia Sotomayor and her peers when she was maybe 9, 10.
Mm-hmm.
And then here we have her on the Supreme Court, or almost.
So maybe we could say Sonia Sotomayor would be better in certain cases in terms of the experience that she could bring, not in any case of judgment that comes before the court, but in certain
right.
cases she would be better posed to put forth a judgment because of issues of empathy and personal experience than, for example, Alito or Roberts, who hadn't had those
yeah.
experiences. I wonder why she didn't put it that way, because I think that's what she
oh,
really meant.
Yeah.
And I wonder why
well,
she didn't defend herself that way. I really wonder, because it's funny, that
right.
could have diffused it all right there if she just said
right.
that.
And I don't think she's allowed to.
What do you mean?
Well,
you think she was coached to...
You know, actually, no, one of my former... I'm an alumna of the New Republic, and one of my former colleagues there has written something on the site that I think is really interesting. It's sort of, it walks through, I'm forgetting the name of the law professor. He just says that he thought that he's a Georgetown law professor. He thought that it was disgraceful that Sotomayor didn't do any of that, that she pretended as though you just put the law through like a sort of, you know, as a meat grinder, and then justice comes out,
mm-hmm.
and that it's important to not be a robot,
sure.
and that she didn't make an articulate defense of the process of judging,
sure.
because she's been asked to sort of just be political and sort of dissemble. But in fact, you know, there are reasons that you do have to make decisions, that you do have to persuade for your liberal or conservative or moderate view of the law. You, as a member of the court, have a responsibility to advocate for a certain vision of American jurisprudence, mm-hmm. and that to pretend that you are opinionless mm-hmm. is spineless and bad. What do you think of that?
Well, to pretend, I think that empathy is something to be completely avoided in making judgment, is to pretend that we don't know what judgment is supposed to be. If you really think about the fact that we're a society and that judgments are necessary, obviously, inherently, in terms of any kind of coherent philosophical condition, trying to get a sense of what something would feel like to another person and adjudicating on the basis of that is part of what we're doing. And it was sad to see Sotomayor having to pretend not to think that and to backtrack and to pretend that she was just a machine, because the whole empathy issue, I think, is a smokescreen being thrown up to mask concerns with other sorts of issues. Anybody who thinks that empathy can be separate from judging is coming from really a different planet, or their mind is wired in a different way. It's unfortunate, and I think that's the second thing that she had to be hung on. First, why is Latina, and then second, whether or not you would use empathy when you're a judge, and the fact that she had to sit there and say no.
She's like, no, no.
She must have done some plays.
That's crazy.
She's a good actress. I mean, that she really, she did a good job of that. And so,
I mean, she spent years navigating, like Barack Obama, different worlds.
What is this thing I keep hearing from you, navigating different worlds? Barack Obama is not African-American. Is that what I'm hearing here?
Wait a minute. We should actually get into this, because I remember reading, your post is up at TNR, and it's about, oh, gosh, I actually want to take issue with you on this. This barbaric yop of sort of wanting to, like, beat one's chest and commune uh-huh. with one's ethnic.
You have quoted me accurately, yep. Barbaric yop.
Which is, I find to be completely ridiculous. Sorry,
but it's
God.
True.
I mean, it's like, sorry, maybe you should explain yourself.
I'm going to
explain what I mean.
And then
you
can tell me why it's ridiculous. What I mean by the barbaric yop, and that's Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal,
right.
who somehow, I mean, I wouldn't expect her, and I don't have any problems with Peggy Noonan, I do not hate Republicans,
I think she's all right.
But I wouldn't expect her in particular to understand why people would attend Reverend Wright's church when, mm-hmm. and I've met some of them, people who go to that church, by and large, are not of those rather colorful politics. And yet, very ordinary people, temperate-minded people who don't believe most of that stuff will sit there clapping. And she was saying that there are two parts of a minority identity, and she analogized it to the Irish, for whatever it's worth. But she was saying mm-hmm. that you can be a middle-class person, you can have education, discrimination can be at the edges of your life, but still, when you hear somebody making a certain kind of statement, in the black case, a kind of 50-60 statement, you applaud along out of a kind of salute to history, out of a salute to the people who've been left behind, and it doesn't necessarily correspond with how you feel sitting in your lawn chair the next day. She called it a barbaric mm-hmm. yawp. And I was saying, what was I saying? Oh, and I was saying that is the sort of sentiment that could infuse why Sonia Sotomayor would tell law students about how a wise Latina would be better as opposed to different. So that's ridiculous.
No, okay. I just find that you just finished sort of asking me to explain why I think Barack Obama moves between two worlds, mm-hmm. which I think should be very obvious. And then in your post, and I've gone and looked it up, no one should be surprised, you say, mm-hmm. that she is both an A1 judicial thinker and also a member of La Raza.
That's right.
Welcome to, and this is all capitalized, accomplished middle-aged people of color 21st century.
It was capitalized, that's right. The initials, that's right. Yeah.
So I agree, I guess is what I'm saying, with the idea, uh-huh. but I wonder why that, I find it a little patronizing to suggest that
I knew people would.
I'm gonna go slum it. Like I'm gonna go slum it with like, you know, I'm gonna go hang out with I'm gonna go eat my Puerto Rican food, you know, with like my family and my people back in the hood.
No.
And then I'm gonna go and have like dinner at 21.
No.
I just find that to be
not eating the food. It's kind of sticking your fist in the air and being divisive. In a way that you can eat all the food you want. I'm talking about Reverend Wright style politics. And
what about like going to the Million Man March? You know, like you shine your best shoes and you put on your ass
and listen to that guy. That is exactly what I mean.
Assistant.
Yep.
And then you go to the
mm-hmm.
Million Man March.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what I mean. If you can go there, listen to the speech that the person who called that march made, and you're sitting there clapping your hands and telling people he's telling it. and you don't believe 75% of it, but it's the tone of the event. It's because there are people who have it worse than you. It's because it's uplifting. It's because it's history. That is precisely what I mean. And I know that might sound a little patronizing, partly because I have a patronizing voice, but I really do think that that is the roots of it. There are two consciousnesses. That doesn't make any sense to you at all?
No, it makes sense to me. I feel like it's not... I don't know. I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I obviously it's very much the reality for a lot of people, but it seems to be just, like, culturally participatory as opposed to meaningfully participatory.
Hmm.
And I just was recently on a panel talking about CNN's Black in America, and The Root is hosting something next week about it in D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically like, you know, there was a segment in which Chris Rock's wife, Malak Compton Rock, takes a bunch of... disadvantaged young people from Bushwick to South Africa.
Right.
So that they can see these kids who are worse off than them, and they can literally, quote, build confidence by sort of being around these other kids whose lives really suck. And I just want it to be of a piece with what you're describing in a way that makes me uncomfortable.
I know what
you mean.
Because
if you're going to go to the Million Men March and... maybe write a check every once in a while to the NAACP, but you're not going to mentor anybody, or you're not going to, like, whatever, support politicians
Ooh.
Who advocate for progressive X, Y, or Z. You're just sort of, like, getting the trappings
Aww.
Without being actually important. Or similarly, just traveling as a 12-year-old to Hialeah outside
oh,
of Cape
Lord.
Town, spending a couple of days tutoring a kid in reading and then bouncing to go keep playing basketball, you know, in Bushwick seems... equally horrible. No?
Oh, you said it. And it sounds better when you say it. I don't want to use those words, but I know what you mean. I think this ties into something I've written a lot about, which is that I think that it's very easy in our times to mistake a gesture for an action when it comes to mm-hmm. the race issue. So in 1960, you were, you know, as a middle-class person, very often it was assumed that you did some work, let me put it further back, 50, you did work for the black poor. The idea was that there was something you were supposed to be doing on a regular basis. If you were a middle-class woman, you probably belonged to some organization. And the organization, you know, was helping black poor people. And that was what you did. Not everybody, but a lot of those lodges, for example, that you hear about mm-hmm. from the old days, that's a lot of what they did. And nowadays, there's a sense that just saying some stuff, you know, you say some lines, you know, we've come a long way, we have a long way to go. Or you wear a t-shirt, or you listen to some conscious rap, or something like that. You've done it. That's your action. That means that you've kind of taken care of it, as opposed to actually sacrificing something, as opposed to actually, you know, trying to get some word out. It's a problem. I think that there's a sense
right.
that stick your fist up in the air and you're doing something, when really just what
right.
you're doing is imitating something you see people in newsreels doing who were sticking their fist up in the air to show that they had done something. And yeah, that
right.
does, it worries me, because in a way
right.
that's the NAACP. Make a lot of
right.
noise, you're going to get mad at something that happened, but nothing has changed for the people you're speaking for 10 years later. Yeah,
right.
I do see what you mean. I don't like to say
it. I also think that, you know, the president has actually not done a lot of, like, fist in the air sort of things. I mean, I was at that 100 Days press conference when Ann Compton of ABC
Oh, you were there. Okay.
asked him, like, what... She was like, so what's to do with race? Like, how's that been? Essentially. Or some paraphrasing, obviously. And he looked a little shocked, and then a little bit irritated, and then a little bit sort of pleased. And then he answered very sort of succinctly, look, I mean, you know, people were psyched about the inauguration. That's all over now. Now, you know, they're more interested in seeing the economy improve. They're more interested in seeing the lot of their children, you know, the opportunities that are afforded to their children expand. They're a lot more interested in seeing whether healthcare is going to happen, whether the planet is not going to burn and bake, and a whole host of other issues that comprise the Democratic Party platform and Obama's platform when he was running for president. And so he's continually focused, and even at the NAACP speech, he focused on talking about issues that were bigger
health
and
right.
race that could be bisected by race, mm-hmm. or the race fits under the canopy of that particular issue, mm-hmm. whether it's education or environmental justice or what have you. But it wasn't just about race. Like,
no.
He wasn't talking about education as a racial thing. He was talking about it as a question of American exceptionalism. He was making it nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
He was saying, we used to be number one in the world, now we're in the middle of the pack, WTF.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was more of a challenge as an American to think of black problems as American problems, right?
Yeah.
And that was a big challenge for a lot of people, and definitely cuts against the prevailing idea of white guilt, which is that those black problems, I'm glad that black president is going to talk to those black people about those black problems. Obama was like, look, we're talking about a bunch of problems here.
Yeah.
And yeah, they affect the black community more, but my plan to fix health here is going to help everyone in America.
And
you know?
Yeah, and this is what I mean in saying, let's see how the NAACP has responded to that sort of thing in, say, 2 years, you know, with all the media that it's getting now for the centennial. Because, yeah, you're absolutely right. It means that, for example, no child left behind. Who knows what's going to happen to it? But to the extent that there are efforts to highlight the disparities between black and white reading and math scores, that's pretty pertinent to the black community. And if on the one hand we can listen to Obama tell a black audience we have to work on education and everybody claps, but then people who are supposed to be responsible have no interest whatsoever in whether No Child Left Behind is made better, made worse, or expunged, are not interested in race the way one is supposed to be in 2009.
Right.
And that's the problem.
Right.
A lot of this, I suppose, is labels. And labels are tough.
Yeah.
But we have to know what to pay attention to, and I'm not sure that we always do at this point. It's alarming, isn't
it? I hear that. Labels are tough,
mm-hmm.
definitely. And I think the trouble, again, returning to the question of audience, the trouble with having a message that has to perform in public is that your audiences will see things really differently. And I guess the best way to hedge against misunderstanding and inefficiencies that result from that misunderstanding is just to sort of be more open about it. You know, this is what Eric Holder asked people to do. And I think Obama sort of followed that template, although he was seemed a little annoyed when that first happened. But, you know, Holder can be the bad cop and Obama can be the good cop, where he's talking about all these issues. And white people, you know, need to sort of overcome the question of guilt and stop thinking about these problems as segmented in the black community, because they're not, and Obama doesn't talk about them like they are.
Yeah.
And so to sort of rejoice at, oh, thank goodness, he told them they had no excuses, is just wrong, because what's your excuse for being so close-minded, you know?
Sure.
Who knows?
Although, you know, the truth is, if you pull the camera back, notice how doing this ending thing here, if you pull the camera back, the very conversation we're having, who would have thought we would have been having it, say, 2 years ago? Just the fact that there is this black
yeah.
president saying these black things to black people in certain
to
ways.
Everybody.
And it's to everybody. I mean, we are present at a really interesting point in history. And, you know, luckily we're not children. You know, I kind of, it's sad
yeah,
watching little children. Looking at people who are 11 now, I find myself thinking, on the one hand, you're going to be a grown-up in a very different America than I knew. But on the other hand, you're too young to really be taking in all of the details. This is just so interesting to
right.
be a part of in that sense.
And if you're really young, you will have never known a president who was not black.
Isn't that the most amazing thing? There's a whole generation who are going to grow up with that. I wrote about that in, I think it was New York Magazine. Yeah, it's going to be really interesting how those people see their lives. It's going to be different from you. It's going to be different from me. It's going to be different. But we have hit that 45-minute mark, and
mm-hmm.
I think that this might be a good place for us to pause it for today. And
absolutely.
We have to pick it up again. This is very good.
I will
good.
Mix it back up with you anytime.
This is fun. Let's let some more weeks of things happen. And I think we're going to have some interesting weeks over the next 3 or 4. And then let's pick
That's
it up.
Right.
Let's pick it back up again.
Absolutely, anytime. This is fun.
Much fun,
Gaia.
Bye-bye.